lead bank and agent bank liability. We are looking at the extent to which the two core agent banks can possibly be held liable in the event of default on the core loan agreement. We'll look at this in terms of heads of liability, common law misrepresentation, statutory misrepresentation and deceit, agency liability, breach of fiduciary duty, breach of agency duty, then breach of fiduciary duty, and then possible regulatory liability as well. We can manage this through a series of core legal devices. First of all, we have limited duty or basis clauses. We can narrowly define the scope and function of the obligations of each party so that they cannot be held liable for something that they were not responsible for. So by narrowing the scope of responsibility, of function and duty, you correspondingly restrict the possible breadth and width of liability. We can then have a series of more specific express limited liability provisions. We can have contractual exclusion clauses. We can protect rights of set-off. We can have rights of estoppel. We can have indemnity. And then we can also contribute through negligence, whereby somebody else is also held partly responsible, including, for example, the party that might be claiming against the agent or the lead bank. If it's one of the other syndicate members, they might be held to be, for example, 50% liable, 40, 20, or 10%. We then have to monitor the extent to which we can exclude liability legally. So we'll look at that in terms of contractual construction. That's called doctrine of contra profferentem. If you draft a clause which protects you against the interest of the other party, that drafting is construed, interpreted against your interest because you drafted the clause. We cannot apply exclusion clauses in relation to five sets of conditions: fraud and fraudulent misrepresentation, criminal liability, statutory liability, where the clause itself is misrepresented, or there's been a separate misrepresentation, which we refer to as a separate oral warranty. We also then have to consider sets of controls, statutory controls. We had what were referred to as the consumer contract regulations under the European Contract Regulations 1999. These have since been incorporated into the Consumer Rights Act 2015. Although those only apply in a retail trade situation, they will not be relevant to the types of contracts that we're looking at. We do have controls on contractual exclusions under the Unfair Contract Terms Act 1977, which generally applies, that applies to negligence under Section 1.1, that incorporates, imports a reasonableness test, which is set out in Section 11.1 and Schedule 2. And we can look at that in further detail. And we also have statutory misrepresentation under the Misrepresentation Act 1967, which reapplies the same unreasonableness test from the Unfair Contract Terms Act. We've also got a series of important case law in this area, which confirms the legal application and validity of these contractual provisions I've just referred to. So we have Recall Catronis, JP Morgan versus Springwell, IFE Funds versus Goldman Sachs, PK Interbank, Deepak Fertilizers, and Abu Dhabi versus Morgan Stanley, and we'll come back and mention the terms, conditions and rulings in those cases in further detail. With regards to overall remedies, if there is default, we can consider the default remedies in terms of five key sets of entitlement: suspension or withdrawing, withholding further funds, cancellation of the obligation to lend under the facility, acceleration of repayment. A large amount of funds may be outstanding, so we demand that to be repaid. We can rescind the contract, and we can sue for damages. So this is an important, exciting area. What we're trying to do is we're trying to manage the rights and duties of all of the parties. We express that in terms of the particular contractual duties created under the documentation. In particular, what we will specifically do with that is control the loss and liability. What we're trying to do in these contracts, in the simpler, smaller syndicated lending contracts, as well as in the more complex, for example, project finance contracts, where there may be 10, 20, 30 different types of risk, we need to allocate all that risk and loss, and we will do that across the parties. There's various rules of understanding, interpretation as to how we will do that in practice. it's essentially the party who's most able to bear the loss will be responsible legally for the loss that's incurred. We can start by looking at this in simple, basic syndicated loan transactions as well as in basic bond note and commercial paper transactions. The same issues arise in both the loan, the banking side, as in the capital market and the security side. So we're looking at liability. The liability itself could attach to, for example, the borrower, the lead manager, other co-lead managers, the syndicate members, and the agent bank. So what we need to do is this. We need to ensure that each party is only responsible for what they were always intended to be responsible for, and that they have no additional liability that they should not be held responsible for going forward in the event of some default. The key default will be if the borrower fails to repay or one of the borrower's group. In that case, the question is, who can the syndicate members sue if they can't sue the borrower or other members in the borrower's group? Remember, the immediate liability will always be the borrower itself, and then the other borrowers who will be co-borrowers under the facility and therefore guarantors under the specific contractual provisions we've referred to separately. I think it's like section 19 of the Loan Market Association Standard Multi-Term Currency Agreement. All of the borrowers are acting as guarantors for each other. So initially, if something goes wrong, you try to reclaim from the immediate borrower, but then you can also go to all the other borrowers in the group. So you've got that form of guarantee responsibility as well. Then it's a question of whoever else may be held liable. This was not treated that seriously in the markets and practice during the 1960s and early 1970s until a famous case called Ray Colcatronis in 1976. Ray Colcatronis, European American Banking Corporation, EABC, had set up a syndicate with a number of American regional banks to provide syndicated facilities to the Colcatronis Shipping Company. The participating banks had argued that the lead manager had a duty to advise them on all material facts relevant to the credit because the arranging bank was expert in international finance as well as in assessing and promoting the relevant participations which it invited all of the other regional banks to become a member of. EABC had then failed in its duty of care in assessing, making untrue statements of material facts and in omitting other facts. And I think that case actually settled with the agent bank accepting and admitting liability. That then became a warning for all other banks in this area to ensure that they had properly recorded all their contractual responsibilities and duties under the relevant provisions that they were entering into. So this was a sort of warning to all other possible participants in these markets subsequently that we had to carefully allocate loss and liability through specifically, expressly drafted contractual clauses. I look in the paper at the main heads of liability. So a party may be liable to another party under the common law for fraudulent, negligent and innocent misrepresentation, and then you've also got subject to criminal penalty with fraudulent misrepresentation and deceit under the Theft Act 1968. Fraudulent misrepresentation arises where a misrepresentation is made with knowledge of its falsity or recklessly not caring whether the statement is true or false. Rescission or damages will be available. A party may be separately liable for negligent misrepresentation where there's been a special relationship or trust and confidence which arguably could arise in a syndicate relationship, but we specifically exclude that not to arise through appropriate contractual clauses. The leading case in this area was Headley Byrne versus Heller Partners. This also requires actual inducement and causation. Now in practice what's going to happen is this. The court's going to look at the nature of the involvement of the particular party being sued. So, for example, in our case, if we're considering the lead bank or the arranging bank, the court will consider to what extent was the manager identified as the source of the information, such as in the information memorandum, and we'll see how we actually transfer responsibility for that expressly back onto the borrower and the borrower's group for this reason. To what extent was the lead manager directly involved in that? It will also, the court will look at the complexity of the transaction, other access to information, the solicitation and benefit. It will look at all of the circumstances to determine whether it would be appropriate in the relevant case to attach liability to the agent bank. What we will see then is this, with regards to different types of information, what we've got is this, misrepresentation applies to statements of fact rather than law, advice or opinion. However, when an opinion or intention was not actually held, that can still constitute a misrepresentation. That was Eddington versus Fitzmaurice. Statements of law are not representations or misrepresentations to the extent that everyone is entitled, everyone is expected to know all of the relevant law, although we need to be careful with other statements of legal capacity, legal validity, legal effect and security. There are other specific circumstances in which case misrepresentations could be held to constitute a legal misrepresentation and to create liability in a particular case. We'll also see that statements of intention are actionable where the intention was not actually held at the time. This may also apply to forecasts which were not held or where there is an implied misrepresentation as to underlying facts. Summaries may also be actionable where they are not fair and misleading. We have to consider all of the possible types of statements that may be made by parties in these cases, and there's a wide range of them, and be able to identify the extent to which possible liability may arise in practice. We've also got innocent misrepresentation. Damages will generally not be available where the misrepresentation has been made innocently unless the reference had been incorporated as a term to the contract. This was the idea that we've mentioned separately about raising representations to warranties and warranties to conditions so that we incorporate them as terms of the contract, because what we're looking for is rescission as the primary remedy. We may not need to exercise rescission, but that gives the banks more power so that they can negotiate on a stronger basis with the borrower's consent. Damages may nevertheless be provided in lieu of rescission now under Section 2.2 of the Misrepresentation Act 1967. Section 2.1 of the Misrepresentation Act applies when a person has entered into a contract after the misrepresentation has made and loss has been suffered. The person making the misrepresentation will be liable without the need to establish fraud unless they can satisfy the new statutory defence of true belief on reasonable grounds that the misrepresentation made was actually true. So that's when we reverse the burden of proof. There's no need to establish fraud now. What we can do is if you clearly prove that a misrepresentation has been made, the onus of proof then transfers to the other party for them to establish that they believed on reasonable belief that the fact was actually true. We then separately have statutory misrepresentation and deceit under the Theft Act 1968, Section 19, and then these other heads of liability. So we'll get possible agency liability and possible fiduciary liability. I outline the main heads of liability and then the court case law in the paper as well. With regards to agency, we're looking at contractual duties, we're looking at care and skill, no delegation, accurate accounts, and no separate bribes. And we will see that in the specific provisions. The agent must carry out the contractual duties and comply with instructions. That was Turpin versus Bilton. An agent was held liable for failing to ensure the principal ship with the ship subsequently being lost. The agent must also obey lawful and reasonable instruction, provided only that it is not illegal. That was the Hermione. And the failure to act will not incur liability unless there has been an assumption of responsibility. That was Henderson versus Merit Syndicus. The agent must generally act within the scope of his authority and not exceed that authority. We'll then also get separate liability in relation to duty of skill and care. The agent must act with reasonable skill and care in the performance of his duties. That was Henderson versus Merit again. The agent must not delegate authority apart from in connection with minor ministerial or administrative acts or necessity. That's D. Bush versus ALT. Agent must keep accurate accounts of all transactions. Pierce versus Green and Lupton versus White. And there must be no bribes. In the Boston deep sea fishing, the defendant was the managing director of the plaintiff company and had received a secret commission from shipbuilders for the construction of fishing smacks and bonuses from two other companies which had not been properly disclosed. So we need to be careful that we don't establish an agency-like relationship, because then it's going to create additional possible liability. Although we refer to the bank as the agent bank, we do not want an agency relationship in law arising. Now the same issue applies, but even more significantly with regards to fiduciary duties. Fiduciary duties are an even higher level of responsibility, whereby effectively the trustee has a heightened level of duty of care to the beneficiaries, so that takes this level of possible liability even higher and the extent of possible loss even further. In connection with fiduciary duties, there's three specific considerations we have to take into account. There can be no conflicts of interest, no secret profit, and there must be proper due diligence. A fiduciary must not put themselves in a position where their duties conflict in any way with their own interest or the interest of another principal. That's Aberdeen Railway versus Blakey Brothers. The agent must not make any secret profit or generate any other profit without the consent and disclosure to the client. Boardman versus Fitz. And the agent must act with due diligence and due care. A trustee must bring to the management of the trust affairs the same care and diligence that a man of ordinary prudence would be expected to in his own concerns. Knox versus McKinnon. So again, what we're trying to ensure is this, that we don't have an implied fiduciary relationship, because that will create an even higher series of further duties which can create possible liability. So there's eight total heads of possible duty and liability under the five agency functions we mentioned, and then under the three possible heads of liability in relation to fiduciaries. Now, we also then have to consider this issue of regulatory liability. In practice, what happens is that we generally assume that the loan agreement and that the loan documentation, including specifically the information memorandum, are not regulated instruments in any form. They're not prospectuses, and they do not constitute any form of direct regulated activity, even to the extent that entering into the loan agreement itself would be regulated, or drawing down funds on the interbank markets. Again, that's not deposit taking. So a lot of the core activities that we carry on in this area will generally not be considered to constitute regulated activities and require separate regulation. In practice, because we're dealing with the largest banks in the world and the largest investment banks, they will usually hold separate authorization and permission anyway in most of the financial centres they're operating in, but still, that would only be relevant in the event that we fail to identify some specific activity which we thought was otherwise not regulated. We need to ensure that all of the particular activities that we're engaging in are not covered by any separate regulated provision, as otherwise we would need to be regulated, authorised for that, or in the UK have separate regulatory permission for that specific activity. And that applies both to the banks making the funds available or drawing down the funds in the interbank markets, as well as to the borrowers themselves. Now, generally, and I've explained all this and discussed all this in the text, the loan agreement and the information memorandum will not be considered to constitute the accepting or taking out of indebtedness, and not be considered to constitute a debenture of any form. Now, there was actually an important case of Fonza, and it was Fonz HF in liquidation versus Corporal Limited and Pillar Securitization. And I've provided the links to this on the system. It was an interesting case, it was an important case, although we're not sure to what extent it remains relevant in this area. That was in 2014. The appeal court had to consider whether shares, the term shares, constituted debentures, and whether debentures constituted loan agreements. Company had entered into two loan agreements. There was a wide definition of shares, which included debentures. The question was, did the debentures include the shares? Now, under the Financial Services and Markets Act 2000, regulated activities are defined by order. They're defined by order of the Treasury, which means they're set out in the separate Regulated Activities Order 2000-2001 as amended. That specifically applies to a number of instruments, including debentures, as well as, under Article 77, any other instrument creating or acknowledging indebtedness. So the question in the law is, does a loan agreement create or acknowledge indebtedness? Now, this went up to the appeal court. In the particular case, the court concluded that it did. And there were specific references, for example, by Mrs. Justice Gloucester, that even the undrawn amounts in a loan agreement, even if the loan agreement was undrawn, that still created or acknowledged indebtedness. Now, we have to consider to what extent that is relevant in our particular cases. What actually happened was that the City of London Law Society realised that this could have very significant implications. Many people, including all of the major law firms in London operating in the Eurodollar markets, had assumed that these weren't regulated. That entering into loan agreements, negotiating, preparing, drafting, executing loan agreements, issuing and distributing information memoranda, none of that would be regulated. Drawing down, making funds available, and then drawing down funds on the interbank markets, none of that should have been regulated, and it was assumed that would not be covered. So this would have had a major impact on the nature and practice and conduct of business in all of the major financial firms in London if this was held to apply more generally. So the City of London Law Society, and again I've provided all the references on the system, they wrote to the Treasury, the Economic Secretary to the Treasury, explained their concerns and asked for further clarification on this. This was actually referred back to the FCA, and there was a response document from the Head of Savings, Investment and Distribution at the FCA, who addressed this to the Loan Market Association in London. And what they stated in this case was that they considered that the decision only applied on the particular facts, so it was an issue of contractual construction, definition, interpretation in that particular case, and that it did not apply more generally. Because otherwise, all of the institutions, as well as the borrowers in these markets, would require authorisation to continue to conduct their activities. Now again, we need to consider whether this was correct or not. So we have the reference by Mrs. Justice Gloucester to this extent that an undrawn loan agreement could still constitute a debenture. There was also a separate reference by Lord Justice Peyton that the debenture did not have to have single... Lord Justice Peyton noted that a debenture did not have any single fixed meaning and that it could include all sorts of different types of provisions, which is why in this particular case they considered that the debenture would include the loan agreements. Now, just on reflection, does a loan agreement, and in particular the type of syndicated loan documentation that we're looking at, does that create indebtedness? Or does it acknowledge indebtedness? Is indebtedness created or acknowledged? If we think about it, the loan agreement only sets up the terms and conditions under which funds are advanced. It creates a relationship between the parties. It doesn't actually create indebtedness. The indebtedness is created on drawdown. When the parties exercise the right to draw funds under the facility, that creates the indebtedness. And we confirmed all that when we look at the fact that you can have multiple agreements executed under the single loan document with multiple borrowers, multiple banks. They are all specifically and expressly stated in the document to create separate loans and divided loans, divided obligations. So I think it's highly questionable whether the loan agreement of itself creates the indebtedness. The indebtedness is created subsequently. Under a contractual law analysis, what effectively happens is when you draw down funds, you make an offer to the bank to borrow a specific amount at a specific rate for a specific period, and that offer is then accepted by the bank by making the funds available. So I think even under basic contractual law, the offer and acceptance is not made by the bank to the borrower, it's made by the borrower to the bank. Now again, does the loan agreement acknowledge indebtedness? Well, the loan agreement's executed before the funds are drawn down. How can it acknowledge indebtedness when there's no indebtedness drawn down under the loan agreement in the first place? You can't acknowledge the indebtedness which has not been created yet. So when you say create or acknowledge indebtedness, you're acknowledging an indebtedness already in existence. So again, I personally don't understand how this would apply in this particular case. I think what they were trying to do on the facts of the particular circumstances in this particular case with regards to that company, they wanted to include and extend the definition of shares as widely as possible to debentures and then include within that loan agreements. I don't think this would apply more generally. I think if this went up to the House of Lords, this may also be overturned. But what the judges actually said was that the orthodoxy was wrong. The appeal court dismissed as wrong the orthodox view that loan agreements which are undrawn at the time of signing do not create or acknowledge debt. So they actually expressly stated that this was wrong. So you form your own opinion. The City of London Law Society, in discussion with the Treasury and separately in discussion with the Financial Conduct Authority, have concluded that the law was not otherwise changed in this area and that there was no need to consider the regulatory perimeter or regulatory limits that would otherwise apply. Another issue that arises in this area is whether the issuance of the information memorandum and the circulation of that constitutes a form of financial promotion. This is provided for under Section 20 and 21 of the Financial Services and Markets Act 2000. Section 19 requires authorisation. Section 20 requires specific permission to conduct a particular activity. And Section 21 refers to financial promotions. Generally, financial promotions must be issued or approved by an authorised person and must be fair, clear and not misleading. It was generally assumed that that would not apply to information memoranda because that was not tied to a regulated activities directly. In practice, there will be a large number of exemptions which will usually be relevant in this particular case. These exemptions are set out in what's called the Financial Promotions Order, the FPO. So the regulated activities are defined under the Regulated Activities Order, the RAO. All the exemptions, the exclusions on promotion are in the Financial Promotions Order, the FPO. That will generally apply to other authorised parties, expert investors, other counterparties in the markets, and generally it will not be relevant in the particular cases that we are looking at. What may be an issue in the capital market deals is that the prospectus that's prepared, if it's going to be issued to the general public, will constitute a prospectus, an offering circular, or a listing particular, and therefore have to comply with the relevant provisions that would be applicable in practice. In those cases, we then have to look at the listing rules, we have to look at the prospectus rules, and the disclosure and transparency rules. This is where we're going to make a general public offering so that the bond, note or commercial paper programme is being sold to the general public. We then have to apply for listing to the listing authority and then we have to get approval and comply with all the relevant provisions to that extent, as well as we will separately then apply for listing on a particular stock market or exchange. So there's a lot of additional work that applies if we're going for public offerings, and therefore we will have to consider the detailed regulatory provisions that would otherwise be relevant. There are some other regulatory issues we have to be aware of. For example, market abuse. It's very easy in these circumstances to give advice about purchasing or selling financial instruments. Could that constitute market abuse? Market abuse itself has been extended to include the misuse of information, misleading impressions, and market distortion. And then again, that can now include insider dealing, improper disclosure, manipulated transactions, manipulating devices. This is a separate criminal offence if it's insider trading, which is covered by the Criminal Justice Act 1993. We've also got market manipulation under Section 397. We have to be careful that we don't breach any of these specific provisions. Again, however, this will generally only apply in the securities area, the capital markets, rather than the loan or the banking area. But we still have to be aware of these. There was provision for market abuse under Section 118 of the Financial Services and Markets Act 2000. That was then replaced by the provisions in the European Market Abuse Regulation. The Market Abuse Regulation was then restated, reissued under Regulation 596/2014. We simply have to be aware of those and ensure that our clients do not engage in any activity which may otherwise be considered to constitute an abuse of any of these provisions. If we breach a regulatory rule, we can be held liable for breach of statutory duty. This was Section 150 of the Financial Services and Markets Act. It's now Section 138D. 138D of the same Act as amended by the Financial Services Act 2012, which were the amendments brought into effect under the global financial crisis. An individual can sue if there's loss suffered as a result of breach of a statutory duty. We can have potential liability in that area. We need to consider that. It will not generally apply in this case because it's not available for companies, and we're generally only dealing with large expert professional firms in this area rather than with individuals. But again, it's still something you need to be aware of just in case it's relevant to a specific fact pattern that you're involved with. Now, how do we control this liability in practice? We can have a series of what we call no duty or basis clauses, whereby we restrict and narrow the role, function and duties of the particular parties to such an extent that we cannot actually create any specific area of fault. The easiest way to do this is through no duty clauses. So we're going to narrowly specify the scope of function of each of the parties so that we cannot be held liable for something that we were technically not responsible for in the first place. We can see that through a series of clauses in the LMA. So what I've simply done is I've gone through the LMA and drawn out all of the specific no duty or basis clauses and identified those. So for example, the information memorandum will record that the arrangement has been requested by the borrower to put the facility together and that no other duties have been assumed. This will be confirmed in the facility document. The role and function of the agent bank will also be narrowly defined. The agreement will record the agent's appointment and authority and specify its limited receipt, payment, banking, notification and default duties. We have specific clauses on information supply, on own credit assessment, on no reliance and no inducement, and then an express no fiduciary duty clause in relation to both the arranging bank and the agent bank in the documentation. What also happens is that there's a specific express clause in the version of the Loan Market Association, the standard documentation that we've referred to previously. It actually says that the arranging bank owes no duty of any form under this document, by implication, to any other party. So that's an express, clear example of a very comprehensive no duty clause. If there's no duty, there's no breach, therefore there's no liability. We can then also have separate contractual provision which can limit liability. These are perfectly enforceable and legal under English law, and there's a series of famous cases in this area. Swiss Atlantique, Photo Productions, George Mitchell, I've referred to those in the footnote. exclusion clauses are perfectly legal, valid. They are not a penalty. They can be fully enforced. We just have to ensure that they're properly revised and applied to cover the specific areas of exclusion that we expect in the particular case. Set off. We have rights of set off. Set off can arise under five major headings in law. We have legal set off, we have equitable set off, we have contractual set off, we have banker set off, which is combination of accounts, combining different accounts, and then we have insolvency set off under the Insolvency Act 1986. Set off is different from netting, and we'll look at netting clauses separately when we deal with financial derivatives and the International Association of Derivatives Association, the International Derivatives Association, ISDA, International Securities Derivatives Association. When we look at this master agreement, what we're going to do is this. We're going to protect set off in favour of the banks, but we're going to exclude set off in favour of the clients or the borrowers. Now, set off is distinct from netting. Netting is provided for under the ISDA documentation in the derivatives area. There's two main types of netting. We have continuous or payment netting, and we have close-out netting. Continuous or payment netting means that every period, for example, every Friday of every month at 10 o'clock, we're going to net all of our mutual obligations out. So the banks calculate what they owe each other under all outstanding contracts, and on the same day, in the same currency, they can net all their provisions. If one bank owes 10 million, if the other bank owes 11 million, the net payment's only one. If one bank owes 10, the other bank owes 10, the net's zero. So you net the provisions out. Close-out netting is when you terminate the relationship and you then net out all outstanding obligations. That's much more complex. It involves all sorts of other contracts, all sorts of other currencies. It's a much more sophisticated calculation that has to be carried out, but it's the same thing. You calculate the total amount due by one party to the other party, and then you net the provisions. The difference legally and commercially, economically, between set-off and netting is that set-off is involved with independent, separate, gross obligations. Netting is a single payment that's created within a particular contractual situation. So you set-off independent, separate legal obligations, which would otherwise be gross payments. Netting is a contractual arrangement which calculates a single payment. There's two principal types of netting, so close-out netting and settlement netting, and then you can also, thirdly, have what we call netting by novation. Netting by novation simply means you cancel an obligation and you replace it with a new one. When we transfer loan obligations under the transfer arrangements that we are available in connection with the building a secondary market and loan documentation. Historically, we couldn't transfer loans. But what we can now do is we can transfer loans by assignment, legal or equitable, under section 136 of the Law of Property Act 1925. It has to be in writing, it has to be unconditional, and notice has to be provided. Generally, the banks don't want to give notice. The amount will not be unconditional, mainly because of gross-up clauses. Therefore, we rely on equitable assignment. You can separately transfer by novation. Novation is where you cancel one debt and replace it by another. So, netting by novation, that's what we're doing. We cancel one debt and we replace it by another debt. We can also have indemnities. So, what you will try to do is you will exclude your liability. You will expressly exclude breach of fundamental duty and all sorts of other forms of liability of any form, so it's as wide as absolutely possible. But even if that doesn't work, you'll also protect your set-off. Even if that doesn't work, you'll have a right of indemnity. So even if you have to pay, you then ask for an indemnity to be recompensed for any other loss which may arise, and then all the indemnity clauses are referred to separately in the loan documentation that we have been looking at. We also have contributory negligence under the Law Reform Contributory Negligence Act 1945, where liability and loss is established, the court can still allocate loss between the parties so that the claim might be reduced by anything between 10 and 90%. I also refer in the paper to estoppel, where a claim is made. You can also argue different types of estoppel, which prevent actions succeeding when another party is acted in a way that would otherwise be considered to be inappropriate to allow the claim to proceed. So, for example, when there's been, for example, an implied waiver or some other conduct which has condoned or agreed with something, you will not be able to succeed under estoppel in these cases. This is more of a procedural remedy, but it can still be very useful in practice. Now, we then have to consider the limits on exclusion of liability. These will generally be construed contra profferentem as a matter of contractual construction, as we've already referred to, and then we cannot exclude certain matters. Fraud or fraudulent misrepresentation, criminal liability, statutory liability, where the effect of the exclusion clause has been separately misrepresented, or there's a separate oral warranty, so that a separate undertaking has been given after the clause was entered into in the first place. We then have to look at the other controls that apply, principally under the Unfair Contract Terms Act. The Unfair Contract Terms Act requires that if there's a contractual duty and there's an attempt to exclude that, that will be subject to a reasonableness test, which is expanded in the statutory provisions provided. So we'll see that we have limited liability controls under the Unfair Contract Terms Act, which applies this reasonableness test. That applies with regards to negligence. Negligence means any obligation arising from express and implied terms of the contract, any common law duty, or any other separate common law duty under specific statutory provisions, including Occupiers' Liability Act. A term must be fair and reasonable, having regard to the circumstances which were reasonably ought to have been known to the, or in the contemplation of the parties. Additional guidelines are then set out in Schedule 2. We have to look at the strength and bargaining position of the parties. We have to look at whether the customer received any separate inducement, whether the customer knew or reasonably ought to have known of the existence and extent of the term, and any separate reliance that was expected. In practice, it is generally very easy to satisfy the reasonableness in the types of circumstances that we're looking at, because we're dealing with large companies, professional parties, expert investors or other institutional investors, and everybody's dealing with each other on a principal basis. It's very difficult to establish unreasonableness in such cases, because everybody has full information, full knowledge, there's full disclosure, and everybody's usually also legally advised separately as well. So it would be very difficult to establish unreasonableness in these types of circumstances. We simply have to be aware of this. What's actually happened is, more recently, is that the earlier consumer protection retail provisions that were in the consumer protection regulations, those have since been replaced by the provisions in the Consumer Protection Act 2015, that's sections 61 and 62. Again, that only applies with regards to trade relationships, essentially consumer type relationships. In those cases, there's a slightly different drafting of the nature of the reasonableness test. In that case, you're looking at an unbalanced or a different relationship between the parties, and you're looking to determine whether any unfair advantage has arisen in that case to the detriment of the consumer. But that's more in retail and consumer type situations, which don't apply in the cases that we are looking at. Now, what's happened in practice is that all of these provisions and these types of contractual remedy have been upheld by the courts in a series of important judgments and a series of important decisions. One of the most important, one of the most interesting, was the J.P. Morgan versus Springwell decision in 2008. That involved the Polemis shipping family in Greece. what had happened was they had purchased a large number of Russian GKO notes, GKO-linked notes, and if anyone is Russian, I put the full title in the footnote, in footnote 71. These were tied to Russian sovereign bonds. What they essentially did was they allowed for dollar payments against movements in Russian government note instruments. These were very profitable for a two-year period, although what then happened was, to the market's complete surprise, Russia declared default in August 1998, and there was substantial losses on a large number of instruments in these areas. That meant that, in this case, the Polemis family, through its Springwell Investment Company, suffered very substantial losses. The claim in this case was for $500 million for loss of value in the portfolio and loss of alternative shipping income. What had actually happened was an action was started in America. It was then dismissed on jurisdictional grounds. It then transferred, the dispute transferred to London. JP Morgan Chase, in this case, applied for an order of no liability, and the Springwell, the counterclaim. So the action began in America with one party suing the bank, with the customer suing the bank, and then transferred to London with the bank applying for an order of no liability and the customer counterclaiming for the original amounts involved. Every different type of possible legal claim arose in this case. It was a very interesting case. Almost any type of legal basis of action, an argument was raised on either side, and I summarise and explain all of that in the text. So you'll see, for example, Springwell was claiming for equitable compensation for breach of contract, negligence, breach of duty, negligent misstatement, as well as a claim under Section 2 of the Misrepresentation Act 1967. There was also separate excess profit claims, shipping loss claim, post-default notes claims. Springwell argued that Chase, it was Chase Manhattan Banks, owed it a duty of care to advise on the balance and content of the portfolio and the suitability of the investments, and that following its failure to do so, no reasonable advisor would have allowed Springwell to hold the specific portfolio that was created, including the GKO notes. So there was a duty to advise, a duty of care, and that the content of the portfolio was wholly inappropriate in the circumstances. This should have been well diversified, predominantly based on liquid and low-risk investments, and structured to avoid appreciable risk. That the capital could have been substantially reduced through falling market conditions. What had happened in that case was there had been a Chase advisor, a salesman called Justin Aitkison, who had a close relationship with the Adonis family and the Polemis family, and in particular Adonis Polemis. And Adonis Polemis had this reputation for committing to transactions and deals, signing documents, but never reading the documents. And his understanding was that if he didn't read them, he wasn't liable for the content of them, which is completely contrary to the English law in this case. And in particular, I think that's the Interfoto versus Stiletto decision in the footnotes. Against all of this, Chase argued that there was no advisory relationship, there was no separate liability, and that even if there was liability, all of that had been excluded. In particular, exclusion set out in the master forward agreements, a global master repurchase agreement, two additional letters, and other dealings in developing country securities, and in the term sheets, and in the confirmation notes. So there was multiple statements of no duty and of exclusion of liability. This was Mrs. Justice Gloucester, we mentioned before she went to the appeal court. She considered this, she concluded that although there was a duty of care, it was very low, and that Springwell had not been an execution-only client, but with a very low duty of responsibility. There was no express duty to advise or provide any advice on the content of the portfolio. The judge also considered that the exclusion clauses weren't exclusion clauses, but effectively simply defined the scope of duty. So there were basis clauses, which meant that we didn't even have to consider them in unreasonableness terms because they weren't actually exclusions in the first place. Basically, all of the arguments that were raised were effectively rejected, so this was a complete vindication for the nature operation of the contractual protections and clauses that we're looking at. We also see that reflected in a number of other important decisions, and again, I've provided notes on this in the system. This reviews some of the other interesting recent decisions which apply in this area. So for example, with IFE versus Goldman Sachs International, we have PK Intermark versus Australia and New Zealand Banking Corp. We have Abu Dhabi Commercial, and we have reference to other important decisions in this area. And what you effectively see is this: the same types of situations arise whereby clients lose substantial amounts of money for different reasons due to different claims, but in each of the cases, because of the effect of the no duty clauses and of the exclusion clauses, the court concludes that there is no liability in all of these cases. I go through all of them in further detail in the paper. So Goldman Sachs, PK, and Dermal is also in here as well. The Abu Dhabi Commercial Bank versus Morgan Stanley, it was quite interesting. It focuses on a separate specific point, and that was due to the extent to which it was possible to rely on credit rating agency figures during the global financial crisis. One of the causes of the global financial crisis was that a large number of institutional investors in the markets had relied on the credit ratings produced by the credit rating agencies such as Standard & Poor's, Fitch and Moody's. Even though they didn't have a contractual relationship with them, there was no contractual duty of care in those cases, they were still relying on those ratings that were provided. In this case, in the Abu Dhabi case versus Morgan Stanley had argued that there was no duty of care and that the customer in this case could not have relied on those. In this particular case, the judge actually dismisses that and actually considers that with regards to the particular circumstances of that case, that because the market more generally was relying on these clauses, that the client could in that particular case. The court agreed that the investors were sophisticated, and because the market had come to rely on the accuracy of credit ratings and the independence of the credit rating agencies, that reliance was reasonable. Again, my own professional opinion would be that that's completely wrong. Credit ratings are produced by the credit rating agencies for the particular customers that they contract with. They will then ensure that they have appropriate exclusions which deny any liability in those particular cases. It's impossible for other members and parts of the market to then sue the credit rating agencies in those cases. Everybody is aware of this. Everybody knows this. The problem that arose with the global financial crisis was that the ratings were overpriced, they were overstated, and then when they started to downgrade them, this caused a trigger of default, a spiral in the markets. And in this particular case, I think legally it's wholly inappropriate to say that one party, even though there was no contractual relationship or duty between the credit rating agency and the particular customer, to say that they were entitled to rely on that. In that particular case, I would have agreed completely and wholly with the bank. There was another separate case on Dermala, which is also referred to in the paper, which again confirms all of these other provisions and the general application of the protections that we've identified and which are available in these cases. So we can generally assume, rely that the contractual clauses, the protections that we're going to put in place, will be fully enforced and respected by the courts in practice and in protecting all clients' relevant interests.